Thank you. That was very beautiful. I want to begin today by reading a little story to you about a cowboy named Calloway. Calloway spurred his mount, but his horse couldn't pound the earth any faster. The posse behind him, and made up of gun-slinging hands of the Lazy P Ranch, seemed to be gaining ground on him and his tired horse. But he mused, this is what happens when you ask the wrong question in the wrong town. He searched the terrain ahead for any help this unforgiving landscape could give him. Rocks and dirt and scrub brush were all that the men that he met up on his gaze searching far afield. He caught sight of a shadow that just might be a defile between the cliffs. Riding closer, he whooped in excitement as the shadow disappeared to reveal the entrance of a narrow canyon, one that just might save his skin. Only yards before he reached it, the first errant shots whisked over his head. With the last look over his shoulder, he ducked into the dim-lit canyon, slowly his horse negotiating the thin trail. Once his eyes adjusted to the gloom, he saw that the canyon took a sharp turn just ahead. He urged his spent beast toward it, as shouts behind him warned him that the posse had reached the entrance. Calloway let out a moan of dismay. The canyon and his attempted escape ended 50 feet away in a sheer wall of orange-red rock. His refuge was a box canyon. Sounds like a familiar story, doesn't it? You know, the canyon wall on his left and a cliff on the right. His way was blocked from the front, pursuers approaching from behind. He was caught between a rock and a hard place. The same thing happened to the Israelites, didn't it? They were stuck. They had nowhere to go, and the bad guys were coming to get them. Just before they crossed the Red Sea, the pillar of cloud that had been leading them moved around and stood between them and the Egyptian army. And the Egyptians were in a fog. They couldn't find the Israelites, so they couldn't pursue them and kill them. They couldn't fight in the dark, in the cloud. So God was there to protect them. But even with the miracle that God had performed for them, after they crossed the Red Sea, they looked back. They saw all the dead Egyptian soldiers floating around in the water. They didn't leave Egypt behind them, did they? Even though God continued to lead them with the pillar of fire and a cloud. For the next 40 years, the story of Israel for that entire time, that is basically the story that could be summed up by follow the cloud and pull Egypt along. It was like when they left Egypt, they had all their wagons and their mules and they loaded them all up with all their past history and with all their sins and they brought them out with them. Excuse me. My question is, how much of Egypt are we pulling along with us? You know, prior to the Passover, which we kept just the other night, we examined ourselves to see if there was any faults in us. And we asked God to reveal any secret sins or secret faults that we might have that we don't even know about. And God does. And so we ask him to forgive us. And we go to the Passover and we take of the bread and the wine, which pictures Christ dying for us. And we celebrate that night. The Passover prepares us to leave sin is what it does. You know, we renew our vows that we made at our baptism. That we would follow God, not the world, that we would follow God wherever he leads us. So Egypt is a type of this world, as we know. And just as God called Israel out of the land of Egypt, he called us out of this world. He calls each of us out of our personal Egypt, whatever that is. Only we know what our problems, our sins, and difficulties are. But he tells us that if we look back, then we're not fit for the kingdom. We can't look back. You know, what did Lot's wife do? She looked back at her past sins, and she wanted to go back to the filth that she had just came out of. She loved it, apparently, or she wouldn't have looked back. The Israelites had the same problem. They did the exact same thing. Do we ever look back and want to go back to our old ways? Many have. We all know people who did it. You know, when we left Worldwide, people come out the church door and said, I'm free at last. I don't have to deal with those old commandments anymore. You know, I can break the Sabbath now and I don't have to have a guilty conscience about it. That's what happened to so many people. You know, Israel was never, they never completely rejected God. But if you look at their history, they were always trying to fit the worship of the gods of the people around them into the worship of the true God. And there's a word that describes this. It's called syncretism. Syncretism. And it means an attempted combination or reconciliation of opposing principles, beliefs, or practices, especially in religion. The attempted union of principles or practices, at variance with each other. Irreconcilable. There we go. Sorry. They wanted to combine the things that they were familiar with God's way of life. They were trying to mix them together. And most people are not familiar in this world with God's ways either. In fact, they think that we're just a little bit strange, don't they? At the old job that my wife had, on everybody's birthday, they would go out and buy some kind of dessert and have a little, you know, party, or wouldn't one necessarily party. They just have cakes or cookies or something like that. So Judy went to the person who was in charge of doing that and said, look, my birthday, it fell during the days of unleavened bread. She said, I can't eat cookies or cakes or something like that. So let's maybe have ice cream this time. So she left the room. She went back to her office. And apparently this lady went and talked to the supervisor, and she yelled across the room, Judy, what is leavening anyway? Of course, she was embarrassed. So she yelled back, you know, baking soda, baking powder, yeast. They had no idea what she was talking about. They don't know what that stuff is. And but she was upset because they were just, you know, kind of humiliating her, making fun of her. But the whole office was learning what leavening was. So then they think that we're weird, and they look in their Bible and it says that we're supposed to keep these days. Who's the weird one? Who's the weird people? I don't believe it's us. I believe it's them. You know, Israel wanted to have a relationship with the true God, but try to mix the worship of the Egyptian gods in with that. And we can't worship the things of the world and God at the same time. It can't be done. It's like trying to mix oil and water. It doesn't go together. You know, they had lived a life of slavery, and they were told how and when to do everything. When I was in the military in basic training, the TI or the DI, he was your master. If he said to do something, you just did it. You didn't question it. And those of you who were in the military know that. And they control almost everything you do. They tell you when to get up. They tell you when to go to bed. They tell you when to eat. They tell you everything. If they say jump, you jump. But that's what the Israelites, they got used to living that way. It was normal to them. They didn't have to make any decisions. And some people like that kind of life. Some in the military like that because they don't have to think for themselves. You know, it's all done for you. You know where you stand, and you know what you can and cannot do. And you just get used to that. You get comfortable in that environment. And the Israelites were comfortable. They were used to that way of life, even though they were so badly mistreated. They also were used to see the Egyptians make gods out of all sorts of animals. Everything. They could touch them. They could see them. They could relate to them. And they were statues, you know. They could actually touch them. And the world they lived in, people believed that there were many gods. There were thousands of gods. And since they lived in Egypt, it was only logical for them to worship the gods that were worshipped there. That they didn't know any different. They didn't know any better. They probably prayed to the true God of Israel, but they didn't believe in him the way that they did what they could see. But for the most part, they were living in a society that worshipped, again, hundreds of gods. And they believed pretty much what those gods believed. Remember over in 1 Samuel, turn to 1 Samuel, when the Israelites took the Ark of the Covenant out to battle, let's see what happened. First Samuel 5 and verse 1. Then the Philistines took the ark and brought it from Elbezadar to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the earth before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and they set it up in his place again. And when they arose early the next morning, there he was again, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were broken off on the threshold. Only Dagon's torso was left there. They thought they could control Israel's God by bringing the ark into the land of Dagon that he ruled. And we know that that didn't happen. But the idea of the Philistine people, as it was common in the world in those days, was that Dagon rules in his land and the God of Israel over in his land. But they thought, now we have control over the God of Israel, so we can rule over them. We have the ark. And it didn't happen, did it? The Israelites lived in the land of Egypt. So they believed that the Egyptian God ruled that area. The God, the true God, wasn't as powerful there because for 400 years he couldn't get them out of the land of Egypt. And they were greatly influenced by the thinking of those around them. Just as we can be, if we let it happen. And especially hard for our children who go to these schools out here, which are horrible. And they're pressured all the time by the other kids. And it's hard to resist that. You know, I grew up in the church. And when you go to school, it's hard not to go against the grain. It just really is. After you live in an environment for a while, no matter how bad it might be, you begin to think of it as normal. And you want to maintain those conditions that make you feel comfortable. You know, like a person who goes to prison. A person that is in prison for most of his life. He comes out of prison, he can't relate to the outside world. It's hard. He just can't adjust. It's very difficult. And then that's not normal. What he came out of was normal for him. The Israelites were the same way. They couldn't see the true God. They couldn't relate to him like they could the Egyptian gods. They were right there in front of them. God wasn't. So it made it really hard for them to believe in God. So when they were wandering in the wilderness, they wanted something that they could touch, that they could look at, that they weren't afraid of. That's why they made the golden calf. You know, it'd be hard if you lived that way your whole life. When 400 years, I don't know how long they lived back then, but if you lived that way all the time, you just, like say, get used to it. That's the way you live. So it's very hard for them to change, and without God's Spirit, it was impossible. And we know that with God's Spirit, it's still difficult. It's difficult even with God's Spirit. You would think that after all the miracles that he had performed for them, that they would believe him. But when God went to work to bring the Israelites out of Egypt, he knew he had to prove how powerful he was before they would follow him. He could have changed Pharaoh's heart, you know, so that he just let him go. Eventually he did. But he could have had another nation defeat the Egyptians. But they and the Israelites would just think, well, that nation's gods are stronger than ours. So it wouldn't accomplish anything. God knew he had to show them that he was the most powerful and the most mighty than all the other gods put together. Exodus 12. And verse 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. God is saying, I'm not like all these other gods that you worship. You know, he will execute judgment on anything that we make a god, that we put before him, no matter what it is, house, car, money, it doesn't matter. If we put something before God, he's going to execute judgment on that idol that we worship. He said, I'm the Lord, and I'm going to execute judgment on all the gods of Egypt. You know, maybe why the 10 plagues seemed to be pointed toward the gods that the Egyptians worshiped. They asked their gods to restore the water that God had turned to blood. They couldn't do it. Their gods couldn't protect their crops from the locusts. Their gods couldn't control the weather when God sent the huge hailstorm and all the rest of it. God said, I'm more powerful than you. I can do more than you. So God had to convince them that he was the greatest God, or they would never follow him and never worship him. And we know that many of them didn't anyway. Exodus 13. I'm going to read out of a different translation. But Exodus 13 and verse 17 makes the story come just a little bit more alive. Exodus 13 and verse 17. And when Pharaoh finally let the people go, God did not lead them on the road that runs through Philistine territory, even though that was the shortest way from Egypt to the promised land. God said, if the people are to face with a battle, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. God didn't want them to face war, you know, because they didn't know war. They've never been in war. They never fought a war. They didn't have anyone to lead them in war that was experienced in war. So he said, I'll just avoid all that and I'll send them another way. He didn't want them to be discouraged right out of the box, you know, but he wanted to set things up so that he could show his power. The Egyptians had another god that they placed on the borderland of Egypt. And the reason it was there was to stop any slave that might try to escape Egypt. That's how powerful they thought that idol was. That idol would not let them escape. So on the morning of the last day of unleavened bread, God had brought his people to the foot of that god. It was called Baal of Zephon, on the shore of the Red Sea. On two sides were the mountains, in the back of them were the bad guys, and in front of them the Red Sea. And they and the Egyptians thought they were trapped. So verse 14, verse 1. Then the Lord gave instructions to Moses, tell the people to march to the shore and opposite of Baal Zephon. Then Pharaoh will think the Israelites are confused. They're trapped between the wilderness and the sea. So God said, I want you to camp right in front of this powerful idol, and I want you to see it and know that it's there and why it's there. God was setting Pharaoh up. He had him right where he wanted him. They didn't know it, but he did. In verse 4, it says, "And once again, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after you. I have planned this, so I will receive great glory at the expense of Pharaoh and his armies. After this, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites camped there as they were told. So here come the bad guys. This huge army to destroy the Israelites. Verse 10. As Pharaoh and his army approached, the people of Israel could see them in the distance marching toward them. The people began to panic, and they cried out to the Lord for help. Then they turned against Moses and complained, "Why did you bring us out into the wilderness to die? Weren't there enough graves for us in Egypt? Why did you make us leave? Didn't we tell you to leave us alone while we were still in Egypt? Our Egyptian slavery was far better than dying here out in the wilderness." But Moses told the people, "Don't be afraid. Just stand there and watch, and watch the Lord rescue you. The Egyptians that you see today, you will never see again. The Lord himself will fight for you. You won't have to lift a finger in your defense." God knew what he was doing. He had laid a trap for Pharaoh's army. God was playing Pharaoh like a fiddle. He was manipulating the whole thing. Everything that was going on, God had manipulated it. In Isaiah, it says that God said, "I am the Lord. There is no God besides me." He said, "I will take care of you, even though you don't know me." And we can look back on our life, and we can see where God took care of us before we knew him. I'll give you a couple stories. When I was a boy, I was probably 8 or maybe 9, we had a farm. And me and my buddy were out in the middle of the pond in an inner tube. I didn't know how to swim. He knocked me off that inner tube. And that's all I remember. The next thing I remember, I was on the bank. And I have no clue how I got there. He didn't save me. My mom said I was screaming bloody murder, but I don't remember any of it. But somehow I got on that bank, and after that I could swim. Just another time, I was headed to work, and I was driving probably 70 miles an hour, and this car pulled right out in front of me, and I swerved over to the right on the shoulder to get around him. Well, right in, as soon as I swerved over, I saw this man, and he was changing a flat tire on his car. And in the back window, there was three little kids looking right at me. And somehow, I swerved back to the left in front of the guy who pulled out in front of me, and I was pointed the wrong direction. And I missed that car. I don't even remember it hardly. I could have killed them all. But God controlled that car, because I was going 70 miles an hour, and I turned just like that and was pointed the other direction. No cars coming. There were no cars coming at that time, except that one that was sitting there. But God did this so that we and they would know that from the rising of the sun to the setting, that there's no other God besides him. And he wanted the children of Israel to know that he was the only true God. He wanted them to know that he was working it all out. He's working it out. Sometimes we don't always see it. And we don't want it worked out that way. We want our own way sometimes. But in order to tie up everything neatly and get the point across to everyone, he made sure that the honor went where it should go. And make sure that everyone knows who's in control of everything that's going on. He says, "Let's go to the Red Sea and let's have it out." And God made sure that Pharaoh would accept the challenge, didn't he? Verse 10, it says, they were afraid. I think all of us would be afraid if we had 100,000 men with chariots coming down to kill us, wanting our blood, and we couldn't defend ourselves. kind of like Custer's Last Stand. That's probably how they felt. They had no idea how to fight back. And what were they going to fight with? They didn't have anything to fight with. They didn't take the Egyptians' weapons. They took their gold. So they couldn't fight them. They were just ready just to lie down and let their masters come and take them away. And they said, have mercy on us and take us back. So they cried out to God. And some of them were probably sincere about it. But most of them were just complaining to God. Why have you brought us out here to die? We want to go back. They wanted to go back to where they were, to what they were used to. They wanted to go back to their old sins. That's where they felt comfortable, with their old sins. They once again showed their lack of faith. But the great God didn't need their faith to accomplish his purpose. He divided the sea and the people walked safely through it. When the Israelites told God, this can't happen. It won't work out. No way, no how. And God told them, just start walking. Just start walking and leave the impossible to me. He tells us to do the same thing. He will work it out. When we get discouraged, when we get down, when we have problems and difficulties, just keep doing the right thing, he says. And I'll see that you make it through. And then it comes out right. As I said, sometimes we don't want to do it God's way. We think we know a better way that will come out to our advantage. But that doesn't always work. And can you imagine what it must have been like walking with a wall of water on each side of you? It's just hard to imagine that. You can see the fish, but they don't jump out. You know, I thought about, well, wonder if you could reach in there and grab them. They probably had a lot of fish to eat. They probably put them in their cart as they went through. You know, like kind of like in SeaWorld. At SeaWorld, they had this great big glass round thing that you can walk through, and there's fish all around you. Of course, it wouldn't be, that's not as dramatic as walking through a wall of water, but when they finally got the courage to go through the ocean, they were probably in a big hurry to get through because they were thinking, boy, this water's going to cave in on us at any minute. So we got to hurry up and get through here. They just didn't have any faith in God. In the movie, The Ten Commandments, Moses kept saying, Charlton Heston, don't look back. Don't look back. We need to tell ourselves that. Don't look back. That's not what we need to be concerned about. We don't need to be concerned about our past sins. They were washed away at our baptism. But we like to dig them up. That's just normal and that's natural. That's just what we do, especially if it was something really bad or we thought was really bad. We just like to go back and reminisce about them and beat ourselves up and feel terrible and get down, get discouraged. The Israelites were finally free men. But what happened from that point on is one of the saddest stories in the history of God's people. Once they reached the other side, they rejoiced, didn't they? Remember that? Over in Exodus 14, verse 30. Verse 30. It says in verse 29, it says that the people of Israel had walked through the middle of the sea on dry land, and the water stood up like a wall on both sides. This was how the Lord rescued Israel from the Egyptians that day. And the Israelites could see the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the shore. When the people of Israel saw the mighty power of the Lord that he had displayed against the Egyptians, they feared the Lord and put their faith in him and his servant Moses. Verse 15 and verse 1. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. He has thrown both horse and rider into the sea. And we used to sing that song. It must have been in, I don't think it's in our new hymnal that I know. We used to sing it years ago. We used to sing that. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my victory. He is my God and I will praise him. He is my father's God and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. Yes, the Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and army he threw into the sea. The very best of Pharaoh's officers have been drowned in the sea. I don't think that they ever thanked God again after that. That was the first and last time that I think they thanked God. Look at verse 22. Then Moses led the people of Israel away from the sea, and they moved out into the Sur desert. They traveled in the desert for 3 days without water. When they came to Marah, they finally found water, but the people couldn't drink it because it was bitter. Then the people turned to Moses again. What are we going to drink? They demanded. So Moses cried out for the Lord for help, and the Lord showed him a branch. Moses took the branch and threw it into the water, and it made the water drinkable. It was there at Marah that the Lord laid before them the following conditions to test their faith to him. If you will listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, obeying his commands and laws, then I'll take care of you. And I make sure that the diseases that I send on the Egyptians, they're not going to affect you. You're going to be healed. So God tells them, I am your healer. I will protect you and take care of you no matter what happens to these other people. That he will help them in whatever they might have to go through. Whatever they might have to face. But what happened? Once again, they complained after they'd seen with their own eyes what he had just done for them. But God was once again patient. He's a patient God. Just as he is with us when we complain. He was giving them time to learn. Unfortunately, they never did. But we can, and we must learn. Psalm 78. Psalm 78, verse 40. Oh, how often they rebelled against him in the desert and grieved his heart in the wilderness. Again and again, they tested God's patience and frustrated the Holy One of Israel. That pretty much sums up the problem that they had throughout their history. Over and over and over again is what they did. Verse 42. They forgot about his power and how he rescued from their enemies. They forgot his miraculous signs in Egypt, his wonders on the plain of Zoan. For he turned their rivers into blood, so no one could drink the streams. And on it goes about the 10 plagues that he brought upon them. And the last one, that was it. Killed all the oldest sons in the Egyptians' families. And for all of that, in the midst of all that, they were still seeing the true God the same way the Egyptians viewed theirs. That's hard to believe, isn't it? It was just normal. To think of God with all of those limitations. It seemed normal to bring along with them the Egyptian way of thinking. Because that's all they ever knew. And it was hard to come out of that. And without God's Spirit, they could not do it. Psalm 77. And verse 16. When the Red Sea saw you, O God, its waters looked and trembled. The sea quaked to its very depths. The clouds poured down the rain. The thunder rolled and cracked in the sky. Your arrows of lightning flashed. Your thunder roared from the whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your roar led through the sea, your pathway through the mighty waters, a pathway no one knew was there. You led your people along the road like a flock of sheep, with Moses and Aaron as their shepherds. So we must follow God wherever he leads. The Israelites complained every time God tried to help them and lead them in the way that was best for them. They always dug in their heels and didn't want to go like a stubborn mule that doesn't want to go. We have to learn not to do that. Not to do as they did. We don't want to continually be looking back. We want to be forward looking. Because we have an awesome future ahead of us. And we want to concentrate on that and look forward to that instead of what's behind us. It's done. It's gone. It's water under the bridge, so to speak. Exodus 32. Exodus 32 and verse 1. When Moses failed to come back down the mountain right away, the people went to Aaron. "Look," they said, "make us some gods who can lead us. This man Moses, who you brought us here from Egypt, has disappeared. We don't know what's happened to him." So Aaron said, "Tell your wives and your sons and your daughters to take off all their gold earrings and then bring them to me." And all the people obeyed Aaron and brought him their earrings, and Aaron took the gold and melted it down and tooled it into a shape of a calf. And the people exclaimed, "O Israel, these are the gods who brought you out of Egypt." Unbelievable. When Aaron saw how excited the people were about it, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." I don't think he was talking about the same Lord that they were thinking about, though. So the people got up early the next morning to sacrifice burnt offerings and peace offerings. After this, they celebrated with feasting and drinking and indulged themselves in pagan rivalry. They went right back to what they were, way they were before. Why? Why make an image of a calf and decide that's what God looked like? You know, it's like people in the world will put a picture on the wall that they think looks like Jesus. That's a great insult to God. They think they're worshiping, but they're insulting him when they do something like that. And so they took and put a picture of a cow on the wall or whatever, and they worshiped it. You know, cows aren't the brightest animals on around. You know, you want them to go somewhere and they won't go. Where you don't want them to go, that's where they're going to go. You close the gate, they want to go through it. You open the gate, they won't go through it. They're just not very bright. But that's the way Israel was. That's the way they were. That's the way they were used to doing things. And that's the way it was done in Egypt. So it just seemed right. That's the right way to do it. If that's the way they do it there, then that's the way we should do it. We should bow down to a cow. So once again, instead of trusting and worshiping the true God, they went right back and they loaded up their wagons and they brought the old image of Egypt with them. God continued to work with them, however. For years, he tried to help them to understand who and what he was. And he showed himself in many ways. He was their provider by giving them water in the middle of the desert. They said he couldn't do it. He gave them manna for 6 days, not on the Sabbath. And they tried to go out and collect it on the Sabbath. It wasn't any there. So they complained. So he gave them quail until they threw up. And they still complained. But in spite of everything he did, they continued to hang on tight to their own concepts about God. They hung on to him. They didn't want to let him go. Remember when they sent the 10 spies into the promised land, they came back with grapes the size of a basketball? Many of you remember the old Bible story books. I still have a copy of them. In fact, I was going to bring one and read something out of there, and I forgot to do it. But it was pictures of them bringing grapes on a pole, a cluster of grapes on a pole, and it took 2 men to carry that one cluster. I think it's going to be that way again and the world tomorrow. I think that we'll have so much produce and crops, we won't understand it. We won't have to fertilize the fields like they do now, put chemicals on them. They'll just grow. You know, Joshua and Caleb said, "We can do it. Let's do it. God has opened the door for us, and we can go through that door. We can take the land." But they listened to the evil 10 spies, other 10 spies. They said, "There's too many obstacles. We can't overcome them. It's just too hard. We can't ever have that attitude." There's not too many obstacles. If God is with us, then who is against us? Christ will always make a way for us if we, and the Father, if we listen to them, if we worship them, if we obey them. Again, they had forgotten what God had done. It's so easy to do. God brought them to the border of the promised land and said, let's go in. The people instead listened to the bad reports of the evil spies. They decided that God wasn't strong enough to bring him into the land. They didn't trust God because they always moved away from him. Numbers 14, verse 1. Then all the people began weeping aloud, and they cried all night. Their voices rose in a great chorus of complaint against Moses and Aaron. We wish it, how many times have they said this? We wish we'd have died in Egypt. They just said it over and over and over. Or even here in the wilderness, they wailed. Why is the Lord taking us to this country only to have us die in battle? Our wives and little ones will be carried off as slaves. Let's go out of here and return to Egypt. Then they plotted against amongst themselves. Let's choose a leader and go back to Egypt. So once again, they look back to the slavery and the suffering and the misery that they went through for years, hundreds of years. No freedom to do anything. They were told what to do. They had no control over their lives. Just day after day after day of unspeakable misery and pain, being whipped and tortured and beat. And they're saying, we can go back to that. Because somehow in their minds, Egypt didn't seem that bad to them. They still have had a distorted image of life in Egypt. How could they just forget slavery so quickly? You know, like I said, the person is in prison all their life. They don't relate to the real world. They couldn't get it out of their minds. It was something that was deep in their heart. And just couldn't get rid of it. They couldn't get rid of their false conception of the true God. In their hearts, they turned back to Egypt. They didn't physically go back, but in their hearts they did. They turned back to something God had delivered them out of, and it showed them that was evil and wrong, and that they should leave behind. And he tells us to do the same thing. Psalms 106. Psalms 106 and verse 7. Our ancestors in Egypt were not impressed by the Lord's miracles. They soon forgot his many acts of kindness to them. Instead, they rebelled against him at the Red Sea. Even so, he saved them to defend the honor of his name and to demonstrate his mighty power. He commanded the sea to divide, and a dry path appeared. He led Israel across the sea bottom that was a desert, like dry as a desert. So he rescued them from their enemies and redeemed them from their foes. Then the water returned and covered their enemies. Not one of them survived. Then at last his people believed his promises. Then they finally sang his praise, as we read earlier. Yet how soon or how quickly they forgot what he had done. They wouldn't wait for his counsel. They soon forgot his works. The word forgot means to cease to care or to ignore. They didn't care. They didn't want to remember. So it was just the same as forgotten. Verse 12 said they believed his words and they sang his praise, but they soon forgot. They didn't think about what God had already done. And they failed to remember and think about those things that he had done for them. Verse 14. In the wilderness, their desires ran wild, testing God's patience in the dry land. So he gave them what they asked for, but he sent a plague with it. What did they ask for? They asked for quail and they got sick. The people in the camp were jealous of Moses and envious of Aaron. So he sent hunger, but no food on earth could have satisfied them. There was something missing in their lives because they failed to remember the works of God. Verse 19. The people made a calf at Mount Sinai. They bowed before an image of the made of gold. They traded their glorious God for a statue of a grass-eating ox. They forgot God. They forgot Him. They forgot who saved them. It's not that they couldn't remember. They knew how glorious He was. They'd seen it over and over and over. They just didn't think. It wasn't forefront in their mind. Verse 21, they forgot their Savior, who had done such great things in Egypt, such wonderful things in the land, such awesome deeds at the Red Sea. So He declared He would destroy them. But Moses, His chosen one, stepped between the Lord and the people, and he begged Him to turn His anger and not destroy them. You know, we have an advocate to the Father, Jesus Christ. Does He ever go to the Father and beg that God won't destroy us? We know that He cries and pleads and He positions the Father on our behalf. He talks to Him. He pleads our case, so to speak. The people refused to enter the pleasant land, for they wouldn't believe His promise to care for them. You know, it's just a sad description, but that's the way they were. Even after they left Egypt, they were still pulling the thinking of the Egyptians with them, their values and their ways. Could we be pulling of some of Egypt with us as we go through this life? Do we pull this world's view of God with us? They don't see an active God. They didn't see an active God who really had the power to do things, the power to save people and to help people and deliver people, even though they seen it happen. Philippians 3. In verse 13, and we get Philippians to Colossians. There we go. Philippians 3 and verse 13. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. Paul said, I'm not going to go back to that. We don't pull the world's view of a morality and their view of sin. We don't carry that with us. We can't carry that with us. Their view of correction. You know, God tried to correct the Israelites. They wouldn't listen. The world's view of sin is fun. You know, if you don't do what they do, then you're not having fun. People brag about the things that they do that are wrong. You see it all the time. Whatever it is. People go out and get drunk and say, oh, what fun I had last night. They couldn't remember what they did. So how can that be fun if you didn't remember what you did? Maybe it was fun till they got to the point where they passed out. I don't know. But sin is fun to the carnal mind. And it can become fun to us as well if we will allow it to. Proverbs says, doing wrong is fun for a fool, but wise conduct is pleasure to the wise. Unless it involves tickling the senses with drugs or alcohol, then it's not fun. Or many other things that people do that involve sin, which they think is fun. Proverbs 2. Proverbs 2 and verse 12. Wisdom will save you from evil people, for those whose speech is corrupt. These people turn right ways to walk down dark and evil paths. They rejoice in wrongdoing, and they enjoy evil as it turns things upside down. What they do is crooked, and their ways are wrong. If you don't join in on their dirty jokes and curse like they curse, then you're boring. You know people who couldn't talk without cursing, and it's really frustrating. You know, it's like there's two ways of life, sin and all others' life. Is there sin? Is there life after sin? Can we have fun without sinning? Well, most people in the world don't think so. Can we? Do we pull the world around with us, their view of sin? Or do we pull God's view with us? You know, like I should be ashamed of myself, but, you know, sin sure is fun. How about correction? As I mentioned, I used to have a guy work for me who hated to be corrected. And when I would correct him, he'd say, well, you know, it's not my fault. It's somebody else's or it's yours. He couldn't just say, okay, you know, and just let it go. I won't do it again. I'll try to do better. I'm sorry. And we all do that from time to time, but not every time. But that's the world, the way the world is. It's just normal to blame someone else for your problems. And it comes from Satan. That's where it comes from. Do we pull that attitude around with us? When God corrects us, God says he corrects those that he loves. Correction is hard, isn't it? It says in Proverbs, if you listen to correction, we will grow in understanding. And whoever hates correction will die. And to learn, you must love discipline. But he who hates correction is stupid. Can't get much plainer than that. Chapter 15 of Proverbs. Verse 31. If you listen to constructive criticism, you'll be at home among the wise. In the New King James, it says, he who disdains instructions despises his own soul, in verse 32. Despise your own soul. If you reject criticism, you only harm yourself. But if you listen to correction, you grow in understanding. Fear of the Lord teaches a person to be wise. Humility precedes honor. Is that the attitude we have, or do we, like the world around us, as this guy worked for me, view correction as something to be avoided at all costs? Like, as long as I can hide my problem and not be corrected, then I'm okay. Sometimes we don't realize what we're pulling along with us. You know, like the ancient Israelites, their ways of thinking and living just seem so moral and normal to them. Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witness, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. The race that we are running is going to take a lot of endurance, and it's going to take the rest of our lives. But we must run it. We have no other option. We can't go back to where we were. It's a death sentence if we do. He says there are things that we have to set aside. Every weight and sin that so easily ensnares us or entangles us. It's easy to get entangled in sin. And then it's hard to get out of it once you get in it. Sometimes when we're running this race, we may not realize what we're carrying. What weight we're carrying with us. You know, sometimes we don't realize the things that are holding us back until we really focus on running this Christian life. As we did before the Passover, we examined ourselves to look and see what's holding me back. Show me, Father. I need to know so that I can ask for forgiveness, so that I can overcome it. You can't overcome what you don't know. It could be something that's not necessarily wrong or sin, but it might be weighing us down in that it's taking us away from spending more time with God. We have to decide for ourselves what that might be. Living a spiritually unleavened life cannot stop. We can't take a break. We can't go back to our old ways where we came. The ways we have to come out of sin, we have to make changes. We have to come out of sin, and they're supposed to be permanent changes, not temporary. So we have to look at our own self and make sure that we're not pulling in our wagon some of our personal Egypt with us, so that we can say in our heart, I won't go back. I won't go back there. Chapter 6 and verse 9. But beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you. Yes, things that accompany salvation, though we speak in this manner. For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward his name, and that you have ministered to the saints and do minister. He's not going to forget. He's not going to forget us. Are we confident concerning our salvation? Or are we still dragging our past sins with us? No, we can't drag, push, carry, or pull our sins in the kingdom. The Israelites tried, and God said, no, you're not going to do it. So back to the story about Calloway. What should he do? Calloway knew he only had seconds to decide. He could already hear the posse coming towards him, looking around desperately, hoping to find some place, any place, where he could take cover from the inevitable gunfight. His eyes fell on a detail that he had missed before, a narrow trail angled up the face of the right-hand cliff, a trail his sure-footed mount could handle. With a light spur and a soft get-up, the drifting cowhand pointed his horse toward the trail at a swift trot. He was just topping onto the plateau when he heard the shots from the posse below. Calloway smiled, knowing he could live to punch cows another day. Happy trails, everyone.